Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm David Onick, sitting in for Joseph Pache and Lauren Meltzer. Our topic this hour is the push to change the California Environmental Quality Act. In his State of the State address last week, Governor Brown called for reform of the act, known to its friend and foes alike as CEQA. Signed into law in 1970 by Governor Ronald Reagan, CEQA requires all major land use projects in the state to undergo rigorous public environmental review and to mitigate any adverse effects they may cause. Champions of the law point to its successes in protecting our land, air, and water, stopping ill-conceived development projects, and giving the public a voice in important land use decisions. But critics say the law is outdated, stunts economic growth, and has been abused by people wanting to stop projects for non-environmental reasons. And these critics have an ally in the governor, who suggested in his speech that it's time to, quote, rethink and streamline CEQA to cut needless delays. This hour, we'll explore what, if anything, about CEQA should be changed. What kind of legislative action is on the horizon? How has CEQA influenced development in the Bay Area? And what would a change in the law mean for projects and residents here? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are Matt Regan, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at the Bay Area Council. The Bay Area Council is a business-sponsored public policy advocacy organization for the nine-county Bay Area. The council is part of a coalition that wants to see the law changed. Tom Adams, former partner at Adams, Broadwell, Joseph & Cardozo, a San Francisco-based environmental law firm, while he specialized in CEQA and land use litigation. He is also the former board president of the California League of Conservation Voters. Welcome, Tom. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much.
We also have Jennifer Hernandez, a partner with the global law firm Holland & Knight, where she chairs the National Environmental Team and leads the West Coast Land Use and Environment Practice Group. She is a member of the CEQA Working Group's legal team, which advocates for changes to CEQA. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And joining me on the phone is Rick Frank, professor of environmental practice and director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center at UC Davis School of Law, and my former colleague at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Welcome, Rick.
Hello, David.
Okay, and we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on KALW.org or on our Facebook page. Rick, let me start with you to set the table here. What is CEQA and why is it important?
Well, I think of CEQA as a so-called look before you leap law. As you mentioned, it was enacted by a Republican governor and legislature in 1970. It's patterned on a federal law, the National Environmental Policy Act, passed by Congress a year earlier. It applies to California state and local governments. It applies to a variety of things they do, public works projects such as building of a city hall or a hospital that government carries out itself. It applies to projects that state and local governments fund through grants and the like. And third, and most controversially for the purpose of this conversation, it also applies to private projects that are subject to regulatory review and approval by state or local governments. And the statute requires that an environmental impact report, a detailed environmental document, be prepared if any such project proposed could have a significant effect on California's environment. The law finally has three major objectives, as found by the courts. First, to require state and local government decision makers to think about environmental consequences of projects before they approve them, fund them, or build them. Second, to allow interested members of the public to be armed with the information they need to participate in a meaningful way in the government review process. And third and finally, and something that distinguishes CEQA from the federal law in which it's patterned, there's a requirement in CEQA that state and local governments adopt either project alternatives or mitigation measures that minimize or avoid identified significant environmental effects of a proposed project to the maximum extent feasible.
Well, thanks a lot for that background, Rick. Matt Regan, let me now turn to you. The Bay Area Council is leading a coalition of groups that wants to change CEQA. In your view, what's not working?
Well, David, if we can step back just a little bit and add some context to the conversation, CEQA is California's primary land use regulation. And I've had this conversation with Tom several times. We have a lot more in common than we have that divides us. If we all agree that sustainable development is important and it's the way that we need to grow, that urban infill development is much preferable to suburban sprawl. As a matter of fact, if we were to draw maps of California and where we would concentrate growth, Tom's map and my map would probably look very similar. Where we are divided and where we have differences is in how we accomplish that common goal. And I think, and the organization I work for thinks, that CEQA doesn't adequately protect us from modern environmental threats, and it hasn't, in its 40-year history, protected us from the types of development patterns that we think are unsustainable. CEQA has two major problems, in my perspective. The first is a policy problem. It's a 40-year-old law. It was designed to protect us from 40-year-old environmental threats, 1960s-era environmental threats. It doesn't adequately address 21st-century environmental threats, primarily climate change. And the second major problem is a process problem. And as Tom will probably point out, CEQA allows good people to stop bad projects, and there are many examples of that. But the law also gives bad people the exact same powers to stop good projects. CEQA doesn't have the ability to differentiate. It doesn't differentiate between a coal-powered power station and an urban infill transit-oriented development with solar panels on the roof. It makes both projects jump through the same flaming hoops and exposes both project sponsors to the same litigation risks. We think that we need a smarter law that can differentiate and that better addresses modern environmental threats.
Tom Adams, you've worked on these issues for a long time. What is your response to Matt's two points about the major problems with CEQA?
If you could tell what a good project was and that there were going to be no significant effects on an environment in advance, you wouldn't need that. But you can't tell. People may want a freeway. It may be a good project, but maybe it's going to have a wide variety of bad environmental impacts. People may want to build a transit system, which we all recognize are necessary, but there can be a lot of serious effects to even a transit system. Urban infill has been proposed in areas that really should have been protected for urban parks. So you can't, without going through a process of evaluation, just say, oh, this set of projects, because some elite groups like them, are good. There needs to be an evaluation. Secondly, one of the most troubling allegations that the opponents of CEQA make is that there are some bad people that are abusing the law. That's fundamentally un-American. We believe in the United States in the rule of law. It doesn't make any difference whether you're black or white or Asian or an American Indian, whether you're rich or poor, whether you're well-connected or not, whether you're a business or a labor union. If you take your case to the court, it should be decided on the merits of the case, not whether the court thinks you're a good person or not. And what the opponents are doing is trying to say that there's some people, they don't know what their motives are, but they're willing to allege that they have bad motives, and that these cases should be decided whether the person in front of the court is a good person or not, not on whether or not the law has been adhered to. And I think that if we believe in the rule of law, these cases should be decided on their merits.
Jennifer, if you could talk to that point. One of the major arguments of proponents of changing CEQA is that there's too much litigation that is holding up good projects. Again, bad people holding up good projects. And a statistic that has been often cited is that 50%, that you have a 50-50 chance of winning in court. It seems to me that if the folks who are going forward with CEQA lawsuits are winning 50% of the time, that would actually be an argument for the other side, that in fact, if 50% of the time courts are saying that these that they are correct, that we do want to keep the courts open to them. What would be your response to that?
Sure. So CEQA is something that I really love, and I am a supporter of CEQA, certainly not an opponent. It has an incredible opportunity, creates an incredible opportunity for informed disclosure, public comment, and really good environmental decision making. nothing that anyone who is supporting relooking at this 40-year-old statute, nothing that any of us are proposing would undermine that, would create any exemptions, or frankly, kind of get in the way of what's now a really important part of our public conversation, which is what are the environmental consequences of what we're proposing. That's critical. But the litigation statistic you noted was a 50-50 win-loss rate. That suggests something's wrong. Tom talked about a rule of law. Well, maybe it's because kind of bad people are doing bad environmental documents. You know, there's a project called Newhall, which was the second round EIR for development that was actually consistent with our climate regime, our climate mandate, SB 375, that went through a full EIR, had to go through a second full EIR. That second EIR took 6 years, $10 million, and the lawyers advising the agency on how to do the EIR were the California Attorney General's office. A court nevertheless concluded that they got more than a dozen things wrong. How can that be? The way CEQA law has evolved, it's getting about 100, 120 questions right in front of a judge 3 years after the report is done. We actually don't know how to do that. A 50-50 chance of winning really isn't the rule of law anymore. It's a coin toss. And with that kind of leverage, if you know you get sued, you're going to lose 50% of the time, CEQA can be leveraged for any number of purposes, and it is.
Well, let me talk about that point of leveraging, Tom, and go back to you. There are certain plans that most people think would be very environmentally beneficial. For example, here in San Francisco, we had the San Francisco bike plan that was held up for a long time due to CEQA. Can you respond to that particular issue or similar issues or the overall contention that, again, sometimes people who are trying to stop things that would actually help the environment for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with the environment but might be one business trying to get a competitive edge on another business or something of the sort? And could you specifically talk about the issue of bikes in San Francisco?
Last year, I and many others supported a bill by Senator Michael Rubio to grant an exemption for bicycle plans from CEQA. And at the end of the session, Senator Rubio decided not to take that bill to a vote on the assembly floor, and instead he introduced a bill which Jennifer and others were supporting, which would have really eviscerated the Environmental Quality Act. I think that bill should have been acted on last year, and I think it should be enacted on this year, and why it was dropped is frankly a mystery to me. I would like to comment just briefly on the Newhall Ranch case, which is a huge sprawl project on the border of Kern County and Los Angeles County. In that case, the court found that that project was going to emit over 200,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions. And the court found that the effort that the drafters of that EIR had made to address greenhouse gases violated rules that the California Supreme Court has laid down quite clearly. And greenhouse gas emissions are one of the most important issues that we face here in California and on the entire planet. And the failure to analyze greenhouse gas emissions from a sprawl subdivision, a huge sprawl subdivision, was a major defect. That's not some technical matter that should be overlooked. And the judge in that case issued a 42-page single-space decision carefully analyzing each of the issues and found some, I think, glaring defects, and appropriately so.
You mentioned the bill last year at the end of the legislative session. I want to get all of your views on that and the bill's likely to move forward in the coming weeks here. So at the end of the last legislative session, a bill was introduced by Senator Rubio, as you discussed, on many of these issues. Some felt that it was very rushed at the end of the session and it didn't get through at that point. But the governor, Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg, and Senator Rubio have all indicated that they want to move forward swiftly, most likely later this month, with introducing a similar bill without the issue of it being rushed. And I want to get your sense of the politics behind this. Start with you, Tom. You know, Senator Steinberg is someone who has gotten very high marks from environmental groups over his many years of public service, is really thought to be pretty well aligned with them, yet he is coming out for CEQA reform. What do you think is going on politically here, and is there a rift here, or as Matt pointed to, is there enough common ground here to reach some kind of consensus on these issues?
I think there's some really important things that can be done, and let me just say that, you know, people talk about the need to modernize CEQA. In fact, CEQA has been amended over 300 times since 1990. It's been amended 83 times just since 2008. It's a living statute where the legislature responds to changing circumstances and always has, and I expect that process will continue. And there are some important examples of things that could be done now. For example, the administrative record in these CEQA cases is often 10, 20,000 pages long, could be 100,000 pages long. That record should be able to be prepared electronically, available electronically. An electronic record should be able to be filed with the court. CEQA should authorize electronic notices to the public and other people who want to participate in the process. If we allowed for the electronic preparation of the administrative record, it could cut CEQA litigation time at the Superior Court level in half. These would be significant reforms. They wouldn't damage anybody's rights. They would continue to allow public participation. None of the standards would be weakened, and yet we could reduce the burden of litigation significantly. My hope is that Senator Steinberg and others who are like-minded will pursue reforms like those and others that are meaningful but that will protect the strength of the statute.
Rick Frank, can you weigh in on how you see the political situation shaping up in the months to come?
Well, sure. Tom's right. There have been a number of amendments to CEQA over the year, hundreds and hundreds since it was first enacted 40-plus years ago. The problem is, though, that kind of incremental approach has its own downsides. And in recent years, it's been a process of last-minute amendments, some of which are successful, some which, like Senator Rubio's initiative late last summer, were not successful. But that's not a way, in my view, to undertake informed public policy. And it really cuts out the interested public from any debate or legislative committee hearings and the like. The changes to CEQA, as I say, have been very small, in many cases exemptions for particular projects or narrow types of project. And so I, for one, think there's nothing wrong with it. Healthy, four decades after the statute's been passed, to take a deep breath and take a comprehensive look at the extent to which the statute is working well, poorly, or somewhere in between. And what I find encouraging is that it looks like this is going to be a more transparent process in 2013 than it would have been in 2012, when certain legislators were pushing things through at the 11th hour of the legislative session. But the one thing, having followed CEQA for just about all of its history, I see kind of a coalescing of political forces, to answer your question directly, around a serious rethinking and new look at CEQA that I don't think has existed before. You have the business community, both Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature, and as you mentioned, David, in your initial remarks, you've got a progressive governor who is one of the most outspoken advocates of a serious look at CEQA. So I think the planets, political planets, are aligned this year, and like it or not, I think there's going to be a strong debate, and there likely will be comprehensive legislation that we'll be looking at and debating over the next 9 months or so.
Thanks, Rick. We want to talk more about that, but first let me take a brief break to say that this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the push to change the California Environmental Quality Act with our guests, Matt Regan, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at the Bay Area Council, Tom Adams, former partner at Adams, Broadwell, Joseph & Cardozo, and former board president of the California League of Conservation Voters, Jennifer Hernandez, a partner specializing in environmental and land use law with Holland & Knight, and Rick Frank, professor of environmental practice and director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center at the UC Davis School of Law. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Again, the number you can call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Picking up on the politics of this and the governor's interest, again, mentioning it in the State of the State, how much is the governor's interest in changing CEQA based on his big high-speed rail project and his concern that CEQA could get in the way of moving as quickly on that project as he would like to? Matt, how much do you see this paying into the debate?
I would think that the governor's interest in CEQA modernization has much more to do with his experience as mayor of Oakland than anything. As mayor of a large California city where he tried with some success to reinvigorate an urban core in Oakland that had seen degradation for many, many years. The then mayor, Jerry Brown, ran into many, many CEQA roadblocks and problems that had CEQA acted in the best interests of a city and the environment and the people who lived there, those projects would have been expedited, come to market a lot less expensively and in a much quicker time frame. So I think his thinking on CEQA comes from that experience much more than any thoughts to high-speed rail.
Tom, what's your sense of how high-speed rail will influence this debate as it moves forward in the coming months?
I really have no idea. I mean, I do think, and to be brutally frank about it, that the high-speed rail project under the previous managers of that project, I think they were incompetent, and I think that the way they handled CEQA compliance was abysmal. And I think we're all kind of paying the price for their mismanagement, not just on CEQA, but on a wide variety of issues related to high-speed rail. I think a lot of the environmental issues associated with the high-speed rail project are being resolved, and that project is going forward. I doubt that the CEQA issues are going to play a major role in terms of high-speed rail, and I don't think it'll have a big effect on the politics of the statute in this session. I could be wrong, but that's my assessment.
Sure. And Jennifer, I want to ask you about the political situation, too. On the Senate Environmental Quality Committee, Senator Steinberg appointed Senator Rubio chair, it seemed in part because he wanted CEQA to be the lead issue. Senator Rubio, more moderate Democrat, but also packed the committee with a lot of liberal Democrats who have been aligned with environmental groups. So it seems as if he would like to see a compromise here. And I heard Matt talk about that there is a lot of agreement here. I wanted to get your take and whether you think both legislatures will be able to compromise on this issue to move something forward, and also whether the different views expressed here, how much common ground is there between the environmental advocacy community and those who are pushing for change to CEQA?
I think it's pretty early to guess as to the ultimate level of common ground we'll find, although I'm confident we'll find some, and I'm hopeful that we'll find a lot. I think probably one of the most difficult issues to grapple with, and one of the reasons to take a systematic look at CEQA after 40 years, is that CEQA was enacted before all modern environmental law existed. There was no Clean Air Act, no Clean Water Act, no Endangered Species Act. This whole network of laws, more than 100 plus thousands of regulations, tens of thousands now of agency staffers implementing regulations, that just didn't exist in 1970. How should we integrate? And that's the question. How should we integrate environmental protection standards that California is famous for worldwide, is a national leader on? How should we integrate environmental standards adopted since 1970 with CEQA? It's a really tough issue, but that question of standards was actually referenced by the governor in the State of the State address, that CEQA should be modernized, made more predictable with respect to standards. There was an op-ed by three former California governors in yesterday's Sacramento Bee, again focusing on standards. Why? I think it goes back to Tom's question and comment about the rule of law. If SB 375 and AB 32 were adopted and those set the standards by which California was going to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, shouldn't that actually have meaning, even in CEQA? Or should every greenhouse gas section of every EIR be a jump ball? And it's kind of whoever argues what and persuades a judge of it wins. If the California Attorney General actually couldn't get Newhall right, and by the way, that was hundreds of pages of analysis, then why would we think any of us would get it right? And I guess a final point on the politics, this is continuously pointed out as a kind of business issue. There was a very, very compelling letter submitted just a couple of days ago by a group of public agencies that have to comply with CEQA, that don't get money from the federal government, which means our tax dollars don't come back here unless they comply with CEQA. They, too, are calling for standards. Let's set some rules that we all know, and then we can actually comply with them. If we know the rules, we can comply. It's the rules we can't guess at because we can't anticipate judges' decisions 3 years out that have really caused us to have the morass we're in.
Thank you, Jennifer. A quick question for Tom before we'll go to our first caller. Tom, I want to get your view on the possibility of compromise on some of these points. So you said you supported exempting bike plans from CEQA. However, that bill did not go forward. That seems to be one thing that I think everybody here in the studio and on the line seems like they would agree with, that bike plans could be exempted. Are there other things that we're all in agreement with that you would support, like exempting bike plans, that you think should be in any changes going forward?
I think if we wanted to focus on what we could do to encourage transit-oriented development, get people out of cars, provide more housing for people within the urbanized footprint, I think there are things that can be done to do that, and I think those are goals that all of us share. I do think that, there's this business about how you can't get CEQA right is really wrong. Let's take the Attorney General here in San Francisco did a study of CEQA projects that were reviewed under CEQA over an 18-month period. They analyzed over 5,200 projects. Of those projects, 5,172 of them were found to be exempt from CEQA. Now, that what people say is exemptions don't work, exemptions are too risky. But of those 5,172 projects that were in San Francisco found to be exempt, how many of them were subject to a challenge? Five. Of the total 5,200 projects that were reviewed, including some of the most controversial projects in the city and county of San Francisco, how many projects were challenged? 18. There's not a 50% chance of losing these cases. Overwhelmingly, people get these cases right. The Governor's Office of Planning and Research did a survey of planning directors in California to try to find out what are the barriers to urban infill. They got an 87% response rate from local governments to their questionnaire, and those planning directors found that CEQA ranked 12th on the list of barriers to infill. But what happens is you have some big projects, like Newhall Ranch, for example, where people are wealthy developers, they're politically connected, they raise issues about how their project ran into trouble, and they use those anecdotes to tell a story rather than looking comprehensively at how the statute performs throughout the state of California. If you look comprehensively, the risks of litigation are very low. The success rate of plaintiffs is, on an overall basis, not very great. In the Court of Appeal, plaintiffs do better. But this is a statute that we should always look at and try to improve. But if you look at it comprehensively, in San Francisco and around the state, it's performing well as a general matter.
Okay. We are going to go to our first caller. And again, for those listening, you can join the conversation at 415-841-4134. Now let's go to Irvin from Burlingame. Irvin, welcome to the program.
Yes. Good evening. I just wanted to actually follow up with the last item that Tom was mentioning about urban infill. In my review of CEQA applications through the state, it seems I pretty much break them into two applications. One is urban, where the environmental community, for the most part, is trying to push urban infill. And then there's the exurban application where, for the most part, I think that's where CEQA actually was designed, and that is to try to essentially prevent sprawl, bad land use and environmental impacts that come with sprawl. But what I constantly see in what people like to use the term built-out communities is that when you put in a denser project, the most common refrain you hear is the traffic. And the way I understand the way CEQA works against urban infill is that traffic is considered an environmental impact. And then you have this thing called thresholds of significance. So what the leaders, the local or the body that's in charge of applying CEQA, as a mitigation, what they end up doing is downsizing the project. So they make the project less dense, and that's their way of reducing the traffic impact. And of course, that only does, that just moves the projects further out. But that's the fact that these residents that could have been living in the urban area are now going to be living in an exurban area. That's not their concern, because they're not concerned about the excess vehicle miles traveled, because they're coming from a an area that's no longer in their jurisdiction. So my way of compromise would be to try to find one way to apply CEQA in urban areas and one way to apply CEQA in exurban or greenfield areas.
Well, thanks for your call, Irvin. And Jennifer, let me ask you, I know you've done a lot of work on urban infill issues as it relates to CEQA. What would your response to Irvin be?
Irvin, I think you have it exactly right. The fact is that change, especially in an already developed area, is not going to be welcomed by all parties. And CEQA provides a potent tool for anyone, for any reason, to challenge a project that's going to bring more traffic, even that's going to obstruct someone's views, is considered an environmental impact under CEQA. Having a tougher time finding parking, even the simple fact of causing more demand on urban parks or urban schools, any of these are considered environmental impacts under CEQA as a result of a bunch of case law, I think in many cases not well considered, that effectively penalize urban projects as CEQA is currently applied. In fact, in the study that we discussed earlier, in terms of 50-50 win-loss rates for EIRs over time in appellate court cases, 60% of those cases involved urban infill projects. And in fact, for negative declarations and categorical exemption projects, the percentage is even higher in terms of how many projects challenged involve urban infill. And the percentage of wins is even lower. 60% of negative declarations fail in court. It's frankly, as some say, easier to build where the only people around are almond trees. They're unlikely to sue. CEQA in that way has actually encouraged sprawl, and it's a true tragedy. CEQA puts all impacts at the same playing field. My view, your traffic congestion, Tom's greenhouse gas impacts, those are all considered environmental impacts. All of them under CEQA have to be mitigated to the greatest extent feasible. And that means trade-offs that, frankly, I don't think are consistent with our current environmental values.
Rick, what are your thoughts on Urban's comment about urban versus exurban use of CEQA?
Well, I think it is a problem, and I've met with a number of infill developers who are remarkably candid and critical of CEQA as it applies to their projects, and suggest that, as applied at least in some cases, CEQA has operated as a significant disincentive to what they're trying to do and what state policy now is explicitly trying to encourage. So I would say that there have been efforts in the legislature over the last 6 or 7 years incrementally to deal with the problem that's been mentioned by giving infill not a pass under CEQA, but expedited treatment. Those efforts have been controversial, but with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, if anything, I think they've been a little too modest. And the most recent legislation enacted a couple years ago, the jury's still out on whether that's going to expedite infill development that, again, all of us and most Californians would agree is a very good thing and ought to be encouraged to the maximum extent possible.
Let me now read a couple of the web comments that we have received here. One listener writes, CEQA needs to be changed, yes, but it needs to be strengthened, not weakened. Most EIRs now reflect the bias of the municipality that pays for them. To change this, the EIRI consultants should be chosen randomly from a pool of consultants that meet basic requirements and are also evaluated regularly for writing unbiased reports. And another reader writes in, another listener writes in, I have read through the Bay Area Council CEQA Working Group online cases as CEQA abuse. I was wondering how the CEQA Working Group defines abuse, and are there any cases where CEQA was not abusive? Why don't I turn that question to you, Jennifer, since I know you are a part of that working group.
I am, actually, but perhaps Matt would like to take on the Bay Area Council case studies and put some different faces on the projects that are suffering.
Thank you. Abuse is a very subjective term. But I would say that anybody who uses the CEQA statute for non-environmental purposes is abusing that statute. I'm not going to get into a legal battle with Tom. He will clean my clock. But I did go to law school myself many years ago, and I seem to remember there's a doctrine called the clean hands principle, where if you petition the court for relief, you have to come with clean hands. You have to have good motives. And there are many...
But how do you know? I mean, I think the argument is that anyone can hire good lawyers, and there could be a legitimate environmental reason, even if in that person's heart, that's not the reason that they're doing it. I think Tom's point is, how do you know who's good and who's not good?
Well, as I say, the law itself sets the threshold for litigation is so low. So it's often the default mechanism for people to exercise gripes. I'll use one case study as an example. I was in San Francisco City Hall recently watching the review of the Cathedral Hill Hospital project by Sutter Hospital as they were going through their environmental analysis. And there were a lot of people there testifying on the adequacy of the EIR. And the nurses' union were there as well. And the nurses' union had a CEQA attorney there to challenge the adequacy of the EIR. Now, I'm not going to question the motives of the nurses' union, but they were in contract negotiations with Sutter at the time. I think they still are. They were leveraging CEQA for contract negotiation purposes. Now, I would argue that that's an abuse of CEQA. They were not in the room for environmental purposes. They were having a contract negotiation with hospital management in a planning commission forum. That's an abuse of CEQA in my opinion. And we need a law. We need to reform and modernize CEQA so that things like that don't happen.
Tom, your response to situations like that?
I think the people that are involved in the California Environmental Quality Act, all of them have a mix of motives. The developers clearly have a profit motive. They're trying to avoid mitigating as much as possible in order to preserve their maximum profits from the project. You may have local city council or board of supervisors who approve a project because they have some philosophical, ideological perspective, either from the right wing or the left wing. You may have the nurses' union who's coming in. Maybe they do care about what happens in their contract. Let's assume they do. But under the California Environmental Quality Act, all they can raise are environmental issues, and those issues should be judged on whether or not they're valid or not. The search for motives goes in all kinds of directions. Who can say that the California Nurses Association doesn't have some valid concern about the environment? Not Matt, not Jennifer, not me. None of us can say. The question is whether or not they raise a valid issue. That's got to be the way we protect the rule of law in the United States. And frankly, there's a lot of talk among the business community about, people abusing CEQA. There's a story that they frequently tell, if I could just have a second more.
Certainly.
About Moe's gas station down in San Jose, I think. And Moe filed a CEQA claim against somebody across the street who wanted to expand a competing gas station. Well, and that's alleged to be an abuse of CEQA. Well, what happened after Moe lost his CEQA case? Moe filed a federal case against that gas station under the Civil Rights Act. Should we gut the Civil Rights Act because, Moe's now filing a claim like that? I think the answer to that question is no. We should stick by the rule of law, and we should not decide the future of the statute based on a story here or a story there. We should look at how the statute operates comprehensively around the state.
I'm sorry, but the Moe's facts are a little distorted. Is BP was a neighboring gas station that sued Moe's. Moe's is small. BP is not small. They actually sued twice. I don't know whether Moe retaliated against BP for challenging Moe's civil rights, but a large company sued a very small competitor using CEQA about the addition of two pumps on an existing gas station. That's silly. Similarly, it was frankly silly for a Washington Trade Association to sue the city of Manhattan Beach for trying to ban plastic bags. That made it all the way to the California Supreme Court. It wasn't silly. It was actually offensive on any number of levels for people who are challenging affordable housing projects or transitional foster youth projects because they don't want those people. And it's laughable and frankly insulting when they use CEQA to allege that transitional housing for foster youth is going to cause traffic impacts. Please, it's not okay to use environmental law. We fought too hard to improve California's environment to use environmental law to throw some people under the bus for non-environmental reasons. And that's what's happening. And that's why so many public agencies, especially transit agencies, are completely freaked out about CEQA's abuse. The Metro in Los Angeles has been held up for tens of millions of dollars by a guy who brought a CEQA lawsuit against a subway project because he didn't like the way the rules were stacked in eminent domain valuation proceedings. He wasn't going to get enough for his property. Fine, he threatened to take down the entire federal grant program using CEQA. There are examples of abuse. It's frankly incumbent upon us, if we do want a transit-oriented society, to try to end the abuse. We made it. We can change it.
Let's take our final station break, and then we'll continue on with the conversation. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the push to change the California Environmental Quality Act with our guests, Matt Regan, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at the Bay Area Council, Tom Adams, former partner at Adams Broadwell, Joseph Incardozo, and a former board president of the California League of Conservation Voters, Jennifer Hernandez, a partner specializing in environmental and land use law with Holland and Knight, Rick Frank, professor of environmental practice and director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center at the UC Davis School of Law. Again, we invite you to call in with your questions and comments. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Tom, I want to come back to you. This is obviously going to be on the table this legislative session with folks advocating for changes. Environmental groups have said, okay, if you want to change CEQA, we have some changes that we'd like to bring to strengthen CEQA. What are some of those changes that you want to bring to the table instead of just trying to stop things that you disagree with? What are some affirmative changes that you're hoping to make in CEQA? And do you think you can get some compromise and buy-in on some of those issues?
Well, I hope so. There are a couple of issues that are front and center for that. One of them is that, you know, CEQA, as Rick Frank said, requires projects to adopt mitigation measures that will avoid significant effects on the environment to the extent feasible. But there is no outside enforcement of whether those mitigation measures are actually implemented. And it's one of the biggest gaps in the statute. And at a meeting that Jennifer attended and I attended in Sacramento with Senator Steinberg and Senator Rubio, this issue was raised. And importantly, Senator Rubio said he would support strengthening CEQA to allow for the enforcement of mitigation measures. And I think that's something that's been important to the environmental community for a long time. Another improvement that we're looking at is there was a court decision called Biona Wetlands that recently held that under the Environmental Quality Act, you have to look only at the impacts of a project on the environment. You don't look at the impacts of the environment on the project. So, for example, if the project's going to be located someplace where there's going to be sea level rise, you don't have to protect the residents from flooding. But more broadly, under that decision, if a development was going to be located in a landslide area or a fire-prone area or an earthquake area, you would not have to examine any of those issues. And I think there's widespread agreement among a lot of people that that decision is a mistake and that the legislature should reverse that. So there's a couple of examples of improvements that, you know, really clearly should be made.
Rick, what are your thoughts on those improvements that Tom just mentioned?
Well, I think they make a lot of sense, and hopefully they will be part of the discussion. It won't just be a matter of watering down or weakening CEQA, but trying to bring it into a more modern era and dealing with enforcement and issues like climate change and hazardous sites makes all the sense in the world. The other issue that I think that I brought up in some of the discussions that Tom has referenced is, you know, try and bring CEQA in general into the digital age. I mean, we've got the statute was written in 1970 and 1972, and we've got things like a local government is supposed to inform the public that an environmental impact report is prepared by posting a notice, a piece of paper on the bulletin board at the Planning Commission or City Hall, which, you know, may have made sense in 1970, but that's crazy in the digital age. We ought to be requiring that be done online over the Internet. And I don't know if you call that a strengthening of CEQA or just modernizing it. And that kind of reform is something that I've heard no one, including Jennifer and Matt, you know, objecting to. I think that's the kind of consensus-based change that is a good starting point for the broader debate that definitely will take place this year.
Matt, let me ask you about one of the things you have brought up is greater transparency, that's something that you all seem to be in favor of. And as Rick pointed out, there's seems like some very basic technical things that could be done to increase transparency here. What is your group pushing for specifically in terms of transparency in CEQA?
Let me address one comment Tom made very briefly on the Biona decision. We need to be very, very careful when we add additional layers of review and additional layers of required mitigation on projects, because sometimes the consequences of that are A, unintended, and B, unforeseeable. If you look at the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, which is the regional agency here mandated with protecting air quality, that's a lead agency that project proponents have to get approval from for projects of significant impact. They recently produced CEQA guidelines that, for all intents and purposes, redlined a lot of the urban areas in the Bay Area, saying that unless you can mitigate to almost zero environmental impacts on your project, bad air quality that exists in some of these neighborhoods on your project, you can't build there. Now, these are also the same areas where the MTC and ABAG have designated as priority development areas where we ought to be focusing growth. So you have one lead agency saying this is where you ought to build, and another lead agency saying you can't build here, and you have developers pulling their hair out going, we want to build. Where can we build? We're trying to build transit-oriented infill development. We just need some certainty.
Point made there. So, now to my transparency question. What are you pushing in terms of transparency?
Transparency is very important. We've had a great deal of discussion about who filed CEQA lawsuits and why. I think it's important that that folks who pay for CEQA litigation, file CEQA lawsuits, don't do so under the guise of concerned citizens for this, and environmentalists to protect that. If you're BP and you're suing Moe's Gas Station, you cannot file your CEQA lawsuit as a concerned citizen. You have to reveal who you are. If you're paying for CEQA litigation, we would like the court to know who's paying for that litigation. I think that's the most important sunlight that we can shine on CEQA from a transparency perspective.
Any objection to that, Tom?
I'm absolutely shocked that any responsible person is making a suggestion like that. This was a tactic that was used in the South against the NAACP when it filed lawsuits to try to protect the rights of black people. And various states passed laws saying that you had to disclose who was funding the lawsuit, who was making contributions to the NAACP. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in a couple of historic decisions, has held that that violates the First Amendment right of association, that people can band together in order to bring litigation. It's a fundamental right of Americans to be able to go to court. And that kind of disclosure has been held to be unconstitutional now for 50 or 60 years. The California Supreme Court has reinforced that. And to have the business community ignoring the First Amendment rights and bringing these claims is really shocking to me. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the point that Matt raised about the Bay Area Air District.
Go ahead.
The Bay Area Air District was trying to say that, you know, people in some of these urban areas, some of these projects, there may be bad air quality coming from particularly freeways and stuff, and that, you know, the new project should have to find some way to mitigate that. Northern California Building Industry Association filed a lawsuit against the Bay Area Air Quality District. Now, the Bay Area Air Quality District was trying to protect public health and trying to protect air quality. The Building Industry Association sued under CEQA and successfully overturned the Bay Area decision, so they have to go back and do a review on it. Did the business community suddenly raise concerns about what are the motives of the Building Industry Association in attacking a public health agency under CEQA? No, as far as they were concerned, the motives were fine because they thought it operated in their interest. I think the idea of, you know, attacking people's motives is only when you disagree with the motives of the people. And as I've said, you know, our system is that you win or lose based on whether or not you've got merits to your case, not on, you know, some secret that's hidden in your heart.
I think one of the most important and fundamental problems in America right now is campaign finance. And we have spent decades trying to figure out a fair and appropriate way to understand whether there are moneyed interests behind candidates or issues that we believe are important to know about. We make people who support ballot measures sign on to ballot measures. The idea that this is closer to the civil rights South than campaign finance disclosure is breathtaking. The further truth is using CEQA to litigate is a privilege in California. California doesn't generally create citizen lawsuit rights against a broad range of statutes and agencies. It's pretty limited. It's a privilege here that we think is being abused, and yet the answer is not, so let's take that tool away. No, the answer is simply, if you have multiple motives, disclose them. And if you're worried, by the way, about retaliation or anything else, disclose them to the court. We're actually being much more generous than the campaign disclosure laws. You don't need to disclose them to the public, but the judge should know what it is that you are after.
And then the judge can decide whether...
The judge can decide, yeah. Absolutely. And the issue, by the way, of the Building Industry Association, I wasn't involved in that, but they sued in their own name. They didn't sue under an anonymous Friends of B Street.
Let me jump to Rick Frank here to get your take. You hear a strong disagreement here, Rick, from our panelists in studio on this issue. What's your take?
Well, there was mention made earlier about this plastic bag industry using CEQA to try and halt local governments trying to ban the distribution of plastic bags. That did go to the California Supreme Court, which upheld the Plastic Bag Association's ability to use CEQA. So if there's going to be any change, it has to come from the legislature. The court has spoken, but the legislature can change that. My sense is this may be the nuclear button that is not creates a, you know, a disagreement that can't be bridged in the current legislative session. So I think what might work is the disclosure, the transparency that's been talked about. And I must say I disagree with my friend Tom. I'm not offended by the idea that, you know, requiring folks to disclose you know, who they are or even potentially who they're financed by is not particularly troublesome to me. I mean, we have courts that require that now. When you file a friend of the court brief, and as Jennifer mentions, the governor and others have been strongly pushing, like the Fair Political Practices Commission, to get more sunshine in the campaign campaign funding context as well. So I think there's a lot to be said for transparency in all of these contexts.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left in this program. I'd like to give each of you a short amount of time to have some concluding remarks as we wrap this up. Let's start with you, Matt.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Tom and Jennifer. A great discussion. I think to conclude, I'd like to ask the listeners, we've had 40 years plus of CEQA. Look back at California in the last 40 years and ask yourself, has CEQA prevented sprawl? Has CEQA prevented air degradation? Has CEQA served the purpose that we intended it to serve? Has it protected California's environment? And I think even the most ardent environmentalists would not be able to put their hand on their heart and say, yes, CEQA has prevented the types of sprawl that it's supposed to prevent. As a matter of fact, I would argue that it promotes sprawl by development follows the path of least resistance. And then the resistance occurs in urban areas, forces development out into our suburbs. In California, 40% of our greenhouse gas production comes from vehicular travel, single-family cars. That's above the national average. And that's a direct result of poor planning, poor development policies and practices. And I think we can all agree that needs to change. And hopefully we can fix CEQA in a way that aids and abets that.
Tom Adams, a final word.
CEQA is not just about sprawl, which I share Matt's concern about, but CEQA has protected California residents from tons and tons of toxic air pollution that is not covered by current Clean Air Act laws. It's protected our coast. It has prevented offshore oil drilling. A CEQA case is what led to the preservation of the Santa Monica Mountains, what led to the preservation of the headwaters forest, the redwood trees. It protected the San Francisco Bay from sewage from the Mission Bay developments. The California Environmental Quality Act has filled the gaps in other environmental laws and protected our communities in dozens and dozens of ways. We should always look at ways to improve the statute. We should always be open to considering problems. But this is a statute that has served our state and served public health very well, and the core of CEQA should be protected.
Jennifer Hernandez.
I think if we were trying to be static, if we weren't trying to create a clean, green economy, if we weren't trying to green up our electricity grid with solar and other renewable-powered projects, if we weren't trying to switch from cars to transit, I think CEQA would be fine. CEQA preserves the status quo, and it challenges every change across more than 100 topics, any one of which is enough to defeat the project. I just don't think that's going to get us to where, as a policy matter, California has decided it wants to go. We've made huge investments in attempting to bring BART around the bay. Now every project near a BART station can and often is subject to its own CEQA lawsuit. Decades of investment infrastructure ended.
Rick, Frank, we have about 30 seconds for a final word from you.
Okay, I feel a little bit like Switzerland in this debate. On the one hand, I think that CEQA is not sacrosanct. I think the idea of a comprehensive look and debate about CEQA is healthy after 43 years, and we shouldn't shrink from it. On the other hand, I have no doubt whatsoever that CEQA, and having had CEQA for the last four decades and then some, has made California a far better place to live, work, and recreate than it would have been had we not had the statute in place.
Well, thank you all very much. That's City Visions for this evening. Again, our guests tonight were Matt Regan, Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations for the Bay Area Council, Tom Adams, former partner at Adams, Broadwell, Joseph & Cardozo, Jennifer Hernandez, a partner at Holland & Knight, Rick Frank, Professor of Environmental Practice and Director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center at the UC Davis School of Law. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, let us know what you thought of tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download our podcasts, you can do all that on the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Jansen. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Join regular host Joseph Pache next Monday as we discuss Oakland's pension crisis. This is guest host David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.